the highest in Texas.
Okay, yeah, I was saying that in the midst of all the hubbub of the cocktail hour before the annual winter night banquet, there would be a faint rendering sometimes, according to how many voices we had available. Texans were beginning to get kind of thinned out. Some of them were kind of shy. Frank Field never sang with us. But Joe Franklin did. Joe Franklin would sing The Eyes of Texas with us. And finally we began to recruit some good, strong voices. Let's see. I've got that down here someplace. Oh, John Bynum was one of them. John Bynum could sing a good song, and he learned the words real fast. So we would make him an honorary Texan. So John Bynum sang with us for several years, and Fred McLafferty sang with us for several years. He had a good lusty voice also. Joe Franklin's voice was kind of squeaky.
Yeah, I remember that.
He knew the words obviously because he was a graduate of the University of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was good as long as he lasted, but he wasn't very strong. Well, then we would always arrange to have this little meeting of the singing of the Eyes of Texas very close to the doors that would open up then into the banquet room from the cocktail room, so that we, when the doors open, we would have our choice of tables.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a twofold procedure for this. We would all be sitting together also.
Mm-hmm.
If there were, you know, at a table of 8 or 10. So this was a tradition that went on. And in fact, even after I retired in 1983, when we had the ASMS conference in San Antonio at the Lone Star Brewery,
mm-hmm.
Catherine Fensalow, she knew that I had retired. But she invited me to come to the conference, and I came and spent Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday at the conference. And that's the time when we had the eclipse.
Oh, yes.
The eclipse of the sun, right, practically at noon during the conference, and all these guys had their mirrors shining these eclipses up on the walls of the buildings nearby. It was a great, great day, really. Well, anyhow, that Wednesday evening, she asked me to direct the entire group into singing The Eyes of Texas, which I was very happy to do. And Burnaby Munson joined me, and Fred McLafferty rushed up and says, "Hey, you didn't let me know in advance. I got here too late." And Thomas Otzler was there. And so that was a great evening. One thing that kind of left me feeling funny about this was, within about 3 minutes, all the Texas A&M grads had to go off and gather into one little place and dance around in a circle and sing the Aggie War Hymn. They took it as being a school song, rather than a tradition of the group. But I joined them.
Uh-huh.
I got in there and joined on with them, and I went around and went with their Aggie War Hymn. That was a great evening. Of course, I had 2 or 3 beers by then, too.
Yeah, well, that's what happens. So then I guess ASMS came along and took over in what was period about 69.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
So your involvement with ASMS was as the STM chairman.
For the first few years, the chairman of ASTM E14 was automatically vice president
on the
of
board,
ASMS
board.
And a member of the board of directors.
Yeah.
And so within 2 or 3 years, I was president of ASTM E14 and vice chairman of ASTM E14 and vice president of ASMS. And as such, of course, was on the board of directors. And I was involved, let's see, who was Frank? Harry Svek was president at that time, and Frank Field was a program chairman, and later on the president of ASMS. And there was a very good group of men to work with, and during the time that I was on the board of directors, we rewrote the Constitution completely. And
this was also at the time when they didn't have a professional group do the grunt work.
No, we did it ourselves.
You guys, now you say you served Secretary STM?
That was an experience.
Because you had to keep, what did
no,
you
don't
keep?
Yeah.
Keep track of mailing lists and all that kind of stuff as secretary, or? Well.
Yes. That was back in 1960. I have to look at my brains here.
Because there were some board meetings associated with that too, which you got the excitement of traveling to.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to. Montreal, 1964, June 1964, ASTM E14. I was treasurer of ASTM E14 in 1964 when we had our meeting in Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, Jack Sharkey was secretary, and I was treasurer, and I think Russ Fox was president, and Norman Coggeshall was program chairman. Those were the four officers.
Mm-hmm.
And was that a hassle? Here we were, I was treasurer, we were operating in the foreign country for the first time, with mostly Americans coming to Montreal for this conference, and they don't have any Canadian money. And I don't want to have to make change, and there was a difference of about 5%, as I recall, between the Canadian dollar was worth more at that time than the American dollar. So so the registration fee was something like $6 American, which would be $5.80 or something like that Canadian. Okay, most people would pay no attention to it. Here's my $6. The Canadian would come in and give me his $6 Canadian dollars. Occasionally, a guy would want his change. He wants the difference between the American and the Canadian. Or some people, Americans would come in and they would change their money to Canadian because they're staying in the hotel and eating, mm-hmm. eating at restaurants, etc. They'd have Canadian money and they want to pay in Canadian. I says, $6 American or Canadian. Sorry, can't be worried about this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And they took it very, very well. But I can recall during the early week, of course, when people are coming in and you're getting money, my gosh, Jack Sharkey and I went down to the Bank of Montreal. It was about a four-block walk down the hill from McGill University down to the bank to make this deposit. And I think we went down there and made a deposit twice a day because we didn't want this money hanging around in a hotel, in a hotel room, a hotel lobby. And so we would go down and they would sign us a little cubicle and we would count the money out and we'd take it to a cashier and open up an account. And
mm-hmm.
So everything was done on the up and up. And back in those days, too, let's see. We would have occasionally foreign speakers, or occasionally some symposium chairman would arrange for some notable speaker to be on the program with the proviso that he have a little compensation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so many a time, and this was all done, Jack and I, he was secretary and I was treasurer, we would write notes to ourselves, and we would put $100 cash into an envelope to give to the symposium chairman to give to the as a fee to the speaker or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So we were, you know, fairly loose and easy. Mm-hmm. But we kept count of everything, but we didn't go through putting it into a bank account and writing checks.
Mm-hmm.
We handled the conference on a cash basis,
mm-hmm.
including paying off the hotel. A lot of times we would put the money in the hotel banking system, you might say, the hotel cash box area, and have a private key to that. And then obviously, you always run up a lot of hotel bills for meals for the executive committee and banquets and things of this nature. And obviously, we would collect more money than we expected to have some money left over.
Yeah.
And but we would pay the hotel off cash, and like, you know, $5,600 or whatever, in cash for the banquet on a Wednesday night, and later on, and then what was left over, we would send in to ASTM E14 headquarters. So now, when we decided to go from ASTM E14 to ASMS by now, ASTM E14 has got quite a healthy bank account built up. And at this time, I think I was chairman or vice chairman of ASTM E14, so I had charge of the monies and making reports, etc., to headquarters. And at a pretty, it wasn't a rancorous meeting, but there was some dissension on how we shall divide the money.
Mm-hmm.
Shall, how much shall, because ASTM E14 is going to be a continuing organization, and here is ASMS starting out brand new with not a penny to their name. So we ended up by giving ASMS about 3/4 of the cash on hand that ASTM E14 had built up from 1952 to 1969, 17 years. And there was about $15,000 or $20,000.
Mm-hmm.
And we gave about $15,000 of it. Now, these are not holy numbers, but we gave a major portion of it to ASTM E14. I mean to ASMS. And so ASMS started off on a cash basis, on a good basis, and I was involved in that.
So, but you also, at that point, as I was mentioning, there was a lot of paperwork that had to be taken care of. Did you dump that on, people back in your office, or?
Yeah.
You know, because...
Humble, again, was very, very lax with this. ASTM would furnish the stationery.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you became a president, you got a big batch of paper and envelopes, and I just used the company secretary. And from one office to the next, from one president to the next president, passed it on. They would pass a card file of names and addresses and telephone numbers,
mm-hmm.
and a list.
Yeah.
And of course, that was always changing, adding to, subtracting from, etc., yeah. like that. So, yes, Exxon just donated
the time.
Secretarial time,
which would be quite a considerable
postage
amount.
And things like that to ASTM E14, and it was a good relationship. No harm done to the company. It was piddling to them, of course.
Yeah,
but it was a major help to a young, growing field.
Sure, sure. Well, let's see. There is a list of gentlemen here that you'd written to me about. Did we touch base on these people, Archie Hood?
Archie Hood. Archie Hood was the was my counterpart with Shell in Deer Park. Shell Oil Company, not Shell Development Company.
Yeah.
Shell Oil Company in Deer Park. In other words, he was in the refinery. Or the research laboratories, like we had research laboratories that housed with the refinery in Baytown. He was there, and Jack O'Neill was the head of the group, and Archie Hood was about my age. We golfed together, we sang together, we went to meetings together. When one of us ran out of gallium, which we used for image systems, we would call across the channel and make a trip over and borrow 10 grams of gallium. He was just a delightful person.
So he was like your counterpart, but
with Shell.
With Shell,
right?
Okay, and so he's a competitor, working for a competitor in terms.
Well, he
visited
my lab.
Yeah,
we were willing to share mass spectroscopic information, ways to do things, but not
data.
Company. Process information.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can talk about how to get spectrum. And how to calculate and have a standardized procedures, mm-hmm. and borrow some
tubes and whatever you needed. Yeah.
Lend this, that, and the other.
Okay.
Right. So that was the relationship there.
And there's Joe Franklin is here.
Well, I've mentioned him plenty of times.
Yeah.
All the other names I've mentioned.
Thomas, Frank, Phil, Fred. They say Fred worked. Fred Lamp worked.
Yeah. He. In fact, I've got one of those papers is published with Joe Franklin and Fred Lamp and Lumpkin, I think. He worked in the field of high intensity radiation for a while, and then also in mass spectrometry with Joe, particularly on the ion energetics.
Okay, sure.
area. And then, of course, he left and went to, where did he go? Pennsylvania.
Yeah, up east. Okay, you mentioned Gene Futrell. Did he start there out of school?
No, I don't think so. He had, Gene was with Oak Ridge Laboratories. He came from Dayton.
Okay, I'm not sure. Yeah. I know,
Gene Futrell had been in the area of mass spectrometers, and I can recall him telling me about working when they were first doing the magnetic separation of uranium isotopes with these big old walk-in mass spectrometers.
Mm-hmm.
That Saddam Hussein tried to build some here recently. I'm talking about massive, massive type things where you run them all day and all night, separating U-235 from 237, and then you shut the whole thing down, brake vacuum, go in there and scrape it off the collector, the ion collector, to get a few milligrams. Okay, I think he was involved in that before he came to Baytown.
Okay.
But so he was there a few years, and then I think he went to Utah after that. I don't know.
Yeah, I know he's spent quite a bit. My first connections with Gene were when he was at Utah in this kind of business with the mass spec using, I can't think of the like a chemometrics business, with the paralysis of a mixture and then analyzing it with statistical analysis and multivariate analysis type techniques and that kind of stuff. Okay, we talked about Burnaby. Any more about
Burnaby? Burnaby is a Texan. He's from Horton, Texas, nearby my wife's hometown, actually. And he worked with Joe Franklin and with Frank Field and further development of the research work on the chemical physics.
Mm-hmm.
Mass spectrometer that Frank designed and had built.
Mm-hmm.
Burnaby came a year or two later, I think after Futrell left.
I see.
And Burnaby stayed there for quite a number of years, and of course he's in Delaware now.
Right, yeah. Then you mentioned Thomas Axell.
Sure.
A number of times. What about Waldron? I don't recall.
John Waldron. Do you know who he is?
Oh, yes.
Okay, John Waldron was the old-time chief mass spectroscopist, design engineer with AEI. Right. I recall, let's see, in 19... Well, are we getting too long now?
No.
Okay.
No.
This is a lot of additional information that you can't get from anybody else except me.
Well, that's why I'm here.
Okay. I mentioned very briefly a while ago that we were needing resolving power, and we're talking about resolving power in the league of the 5,000, which would help us to do things, separating 12 hydrogens from one carbon as far as mass is concerned.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't get you any nitrogen or oxygen breakdown, but differences. But you could get quite a bit with that. So we entered into a contract with CEC. I never finished that story. And in about 1960 that they had a 21-110 up and operating for us as a demonstration. Phil Kloss, who was the spectroscopist with Exxon in New Jersey at that time, he and I took my whole family up there. The children were their teenagers. They remember it with great relish. I mean, they had a great time all over Pasadena and Santa Monica, and they were in their teens, and they went to all the museums, and it was a great 3 weeks. But at the end of that period, I saw that the 21-110 was not what CEC hoped for it to be. As far as I could tell, they had made a mistake in design and failed to take into account the width of the slit in trying to calculate the resolving power, the slit itself. So I recommended to Humble that the contract was based on them being able to do certain things.
Mm-hmm.
I recommended to humble that we do not purchase the CEC instrument. I guess I was more hard-hearted than the people up in New Jersey was, because the people up in New Jersey, when they hadn't bought one, mm-hmm. that they never did bear much with, this very first, earliest model. So, about that time, John Bynum, he was with ICI, and AEI, which was a new company, came out of old Metropolitan Vickers mm-hmm. company, came out with the MS-7 or the MS-8. Anyhow, it showed some resolving power. And so we entered into correspondence Metropolitan Vickers was the first few letters that I got. And I kept those letters for many, many years. I don't have any more, I don't think. And then it became AEI. And finally, we entered into a contract with AEI to provide us the MS-9. This is their newest instrument. After the MS-8 that John Bynum had made us salivate for, because he was getting resolving power up around 2,000 or 3,000, and we were still stuck at 600.
Yeah.
So I went over to England for a checkout on the MS-9 in December of 1963 and met John Waldron for the first time. Now we got back to your suggestion of John Waldron. Why John Waldron? I can recall. Back up. CEC was pretty unhappy, of course.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure they were unhappy.
Because here was one of the prime mass spectrometry laboratories in the country, turned them down. But they continued to work, and they finally turned it out a good instrument. But the prototype that we were looking at just didn't do it. And, of course, MS-9 really was quite a bit way ahead of the MS-1, of the CEC-110 anyway.
Yeah, well, there's also that underlying dichotomy with the photoplate detection versus the electrical detection,
yes.
too.
MS-9 had an electrical detection, even though it was a laborious recording oscillograph, but at least you didn't have to run it through a dark room. It was a UV-sensitive paper,
mm-hmm.
Light-sensitive paper. And so I went to England, and John Waldron took me under his arm, and we spent some evenings together. One weekend, we went down from Manchester to the old Roman city of Chester. It's about a 80-mile drive or something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And we went down there for dinner, and he and I walked along the old Roman wall at the city of Chester. I've been back there since then, but mm-hmm. I can remember the experience of being with John Waldron. In the mind of a young spectroscopist like I was, I mean, here was this man who was a top man in this company, a noted scientist who had designed these instruments, etc. So I recall the time that John Waldron spent with me, and sure enough, later on when we got the MS-9, we received it in the fall of '63 and had it installed. He came over and visited us in our home and mm-hmm. had dinner with us and met our children. He was a fine man. And later on, years later, he dropped out of AEI, and then he came back into AEI, and the last time I saw him was in Nebraska, when we had a conference on coal chemistry in Nebraska it was in the presidential election year. Was it, I think the year that, it must have been 64. Were you there at the conference?
I didn't go to that in Nebraska. My beginnings were probably about 67 is maybe the first conference I went to in Dallas. Was there one in 67 in Dallas?
67 was in Denver.
Okay, maybe it was 66 then. Was there one in
66 was in Dallas. Okay. ASTM 14.
Yeah,
Dallas,
I think
66.
That was the first one I ever went to.
Right.
In my history of going to those silly things.
Gosh, I don't.
Yeah, I knew he was principal in the AI operation in Manchester. And
right.
So now you're saying you got one of the earliest MS-9s?
It was the very first one.
Okay.
The very first one that left England. And let's see, I think. ICI and England got two of them, of the first, you might say, batch of five or whatever they were. So I can recall going to school, and that's why some of the other Englishmen's names that they're listed there, Brian Green and
Nigel Bean.
Nigel Bean was an erection engineer. Right. He came over in the fall of 63 and installed the MS-9 in Baytown, and he lived with us. I sure fell in love with this young, unmarried Englishman. Of course, he was in his 20s.
Yeah.
And not sure they were in their teens, but they he had a beautiful singing voice. And after having having him out for dinner one evening, and he was there for months and months, we finally decided, to heck with you living in a motel in Baytown. Just come move into the room with my son, who was about 16 years old at the time. And so Nigel Bean just came and lived with us. Let's see. Brian Green helped me learn how to twist some of the knobs on the MS-9 over in Manchester.
So he was with AEI at the time?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
He told me we still have to turn them, we selected to turn them, to begin to learn how to operate the MS-9. And I spent 3 weeks at the Barton Works in Manchester in 63.
And then when the machine was shipped, Nigel was the engineer that did the installation here.
Nigel Bean was sent over in the fall of 63 and made the installation and ran the acceptance tests and so forth like that. So he was over here a long time. Of course, you know, it takes quite a few months to from the time you unpack one of those things and get it all set up to get it into operation. So he was quite here a number of months. He became a member of the family, really.
Yeah, that sounds like it. What about Martin Elliott then? There's Martin Elliott.
Yeah, Martin Elliott's name is on there because I just thought always very highly of a lot of these very learned Englishmen and their ability to understand and express themselves. Martin Elliott was a favorite of mine, and Sid Evans. His name was there too. Sid Evans came along later to AEI. Than John Waldron. I think Sid Evans, actually, as far as I understand, he was the main designer on the MS-50. And that man just knew more vacuum technology and electronics and physics than any man that I ever spent much time with. And he was involved in the installation of the MS-50. And in making quite a number of trips to Baytown, when we would get in trouble, and once in a while we would call for help, and of course at the ASMS conferences for many, many years. We would always meet and have dinner or go to a museum or something like this together.
Yeah, I haven't seen Sid for a couple of years. I'm wondering, you know, where he's ended up, what he's up to these years. So we did cover, touch base with these various gentlemen. I guess a reasonable number of them, really, the latter group are basically Englishmen that associated with the MS-9
That's the reason I've got their names on there. I guess one of the reasons, when I was looking through some of this old stuff that I had, I found a Christmas card.
Oh, really?
And their names were all on it.
Oh,
nice. It reminded me, hey, I haven't thought about these guys for a long time, and yet they're part of my mass spectrometry. You've got to forget now. I've been gone for 11 years.
Yeah,
this is quite a cultural shock for me to come back into this. Not only for just this session today, but you know, Thomas Otzel died last year, just before the national conference, and there is a symposium planned.
Oh, really?
In his honor, the mass spectrometry of petroleum chemistry, a symposium in honor of Thomas Otzel, Monday morning, June 1, 1992, in Washington, D.C.
Washington Conference.
And Sam Hsu, within 2 weeks after Thomas had died, he had decided that they needed to do this. They probably talked about it at the ASMS conference before the end of the week was over last year in Nashville. But anyhow, he called me and asked within a couple of weeks if I'd be willing to give an 8 or 10 minute talk about my relationships with Thomas. Okay. About about a month ago, he called and asked if I would expand that to a 30-minute talk about some of the exact things that we're talking about now, the early days of mass spectrometry and how mass spectrometry in the field of petroleum chemistry evolved
right.
over the years. So, as I say, this is I'm having to go back and think about things
that
I have
about.
Not thought of. When I retired, I thought at first that it might be a good idea to do a little bit of consulting. You know, a lot of eminent scientists, when they retire, the first thing they want to do is do a little bit of consulting.
Yeah, right on.
So, right on. So, I retired in June, and I'm thinking, my gosh, in July, I was already up in Bartlesville with Shepley, and met with his group of people and his bosses, and actually, they got me up there to pick my brain on the MS-50, mm-hmm. because what they wanted to do was to buy an MS-50, and they wanted me to tell them how it could be used and what wonderful information you could get from it, and I presumably helped them out, and they did buy an MS-50. And so I went up there for a while, and then I went to another conference on petroleum and gave a talk on how mass spectrometry is of value in this field. Mm-hmm. And then I went to New Jersey to talk with them. And after about these three trips, I said, "What did I retire for? I don't want to do this. $100, $150 a day for 2 or 3 days, all this traveling up there and back. Mm-hmm. I'd rather sit here in Round Rock and till my garden and prune my fruit trees and forget about mass spectrometry." And I did.
Uh-huh.
I forgot about it. I went back to the conference in 83 at Catherine Pinsilaw's request. And then I went back to Nashville at your request. Mm-hmm. For this group session that we had with Frank Field and mm-hmm. Jack Sharkey last year. But other than that, it's been out of my mind.
My goodness. Well, you talk about it like it hadn't been out of your mind, so can't be too far away.
I'll tell you what, I had to do some refreshing. You see me referring to this?
Yes.
To these notes here?
Yes. Okay.
Those are the notes that I made based on the outline of what you want to talk about.
Yeah.
And then with this session coming up in June.
It's good.
And,
practice.
Right, this is good practice for that. So I called the main library in Austin and asked them if they had chem abstracts.
Uh-huh.
And the lady said, "Huh?" I said, "Chemical abstracts, you know, the abstracts, all the technical information of journals all over the world." She said, "Oh, no, we don't replicate anything that the University of Texas might have." So last Friday, I went to the University of Texas Library. To the big Mullet Library in the chemistry, Welch Hall.
I see.
And I've got page after page here of reminding myself for this paper that I've got to write for SMS conference.
That's looking get back there and hit up the literature and get the research done.
It did me good to go back and realize that I could still find my way through chem abstracts.
Yeah, without a computer yet, huh?
This is reading the paper.
Yeah, a lot of this stuff now is reduced to doing these computer searches, and you don't even, you know, get close to a book.
Oh, no, this is, you know, this is talking about the stacks,
right?
In the university where they got chem abstracts back to 1907, and you just go pick them out volume by volume and look through on page 14,247D.
Yeah. Fun stuff. So I think we've covered quite a bit. I was wondering if, you know, maybe we can wrap up with some grandiose ideas about where we came from and where we're going. It might be appropriate for your petroleum chemistry talk in June, or if there's any kind of stuff that you want to throw in here, you know, like something fundamental that you've run into in your career that's guided it or something like that.
Well, I think I've already talked about all the past of mass spectroscopy. I certainly have been happy to have been a part of it and to have gotten into the field at a time that I did, because there are very, very few people still active in the field. In fact, I'm not active. There are very few people still alive in the field who remember back those days.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really happy in noting maybe almost 15 years ago, the fact that mass spectrometry is really beginning to make a headways in the field of medical and biologics. I think that, gosh, hopefully they can find something about what causes cancer. I know that mass spectrometry is so ingrained now in all the biological laboratories, in the government laboratories involved in medicines, that this is a hope for the future. Odell and I have talked about this many times. I guess the overall field of science, my field is that people are getting to be a bit too narrow, at least my point of view. You've heard a lot of the things that I did today, just a lot of hands-on, all types of experiences, not any one little narrow field. This is involving separations in chemistry and physics and mathematics and computers and just a whole gamut of work. And I may be wrong, but my feeling is that a lot of students are coming out with fairly narrow outlooks and fairly narrow desires on what they really want to do.
Well, I think there is the business of specialization is a reality, and I've seen that myself.
Yep. The old business of knowing more and more about less and less. Mm-hmm. It might be good in some areas, but I think we still need a lot of broad-minded thinking, just in a lot of areas.
Yes, I agree, and I think that's one of the reasons, and maybe you can give me your ideas about this. That's one of the reasons I enjoy the SMS conference, is because it covers such a broad spectrum of disciplines. I see it as a meeting where people come to, they may be mathematicians, they may be geologists, they may be MDs, they may be biologists, they may be chemists, whatever. They have one thing in common. Right. That's mass spectrometry.
Right. And this, I hardly ever have attended a paper in a completely different area of mass spectrometry and listened that I didn't gain something from it. Mm-hmm. Either a technique or an idea of a way to get something additional out of the information. So yes, I agree with you completely that even though the conference is a very broad conference, mm-hmm. that people ought to go not just attend their day, but to be there and learn from what the other people are doing.
Interact too. The interactions are good. Then one-on-one interactions, and that's harder to do as it gets bigger. But it's still a very interactive group.
Well, I'm looking forward to taking Odell, her health allowing.
Yeah, that would be great.
To in driving, seeing along with some country along the way up to Washington, D.C., and being there for June 1. We'll be there before then, and mm-hmm. stay for a day or two for the conference in 1992. Hope to see you there again.
Yeah, well, I'm planning on being there, but... You know how plans are.
Yes.
They don't always work out right. Well, I don't know. I think we've probably covered pretty broad, thinking of broad areas and topics and whatnot. I think we've covered the turf pretty well, unless you have any other thoughts that you want to throw
in.
Call
it off. And I've enjoyed the conversation, and I probably talked longer than I should. And,
no, not at all.
I don't think I revealed anything that I shouldn't, except for being possibly too verbose.